Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Millennial Love, a podcast from The Independent on everything to do with love, sexuality, identity and more. This week, I'm thrilled to be joined by Sarita Domingo. Sarita joined me to discuss her latest book, Who's Loving You? Love Stories by Women of Colour. The book is a collection of 10 original short stories from female writers of colour, covering love in all its guises, from lost love to forbidden love to unrequited love. We spoke about why a book like this is so necessary and why the romantic fiction sphere is so dominated by white voices. We also talk about why diverse storytelling is so important within the romantic genre in particular and how it can impact the way people behave in their own love lives. And Sarita also spoke about what writing about love has done to impact her own relationships and how she separates fact from fiction. Enjoy the show. Hello.
Hi. Hi there.
How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad, you know, surviving.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best that all of us can say to that question at the moment.
Exactly.
So we are here to talk about your brilliant book, Who's Loving You? So I want to start off by asking you a bit about what made you want to create this wonderful anthology of short stories and what it is about these particular stories that you enjoyed and how you went about, I guess, curating the anthology as well.
It's a collection of love stories written by British women of colour, and having had a couple of novels out myself that have been sort of classed as romantic fiction, when I was going into spaces that were ostensibly for like promoting romance or any of those kind of events, I was often the only person of colour there. And, you know, it did feel quite lonely. I mean, romance as a genre, particularly in the UK, isn't really something that I see a lot of writers of colour pursuing. So I kind of wanted to put together a collection of stories, particularly written by British women of colour, to kind of redress that to a certain degree, but also to just sort of speak to some of my favourite authors, both established and up and coming, and have them write a story based around love that is not necessarily sort of within the constraints of what people always perceive romance to be. Like, I think people have a lot of preconceptions about romance fiction, and I wanted these writers to feel free to sort of write on the topic in whatever way they saw fit. So it was kind of, about approaching these writers and seeing if they'd be up for doing that.
I feel like you describe yourself on your website as a hopeless but realistic romantic. I feel like you have like a similar fascination with romance as I do. What is it about that kind of genre of writing and that, I guess that genre of popular culture more generally, that you find so compelling? And have you always found it so compelling?
I think I have, yeah. And I think the key thing for me, at least, is the vicarious feeling of romantic stories, romantic fiction, or romantic films. It's getting to live that experience of falling in love again and again and again, because who doesn't enjoy that feeling? And even if, you know, I'm married and I'm in a committed relationship, but it's still such a compelling thing to live that experience through other people and have all sorts of different scenarios that you can live through those works. So I think that's the thing that I find most compelling about it.
I completely agree, and that fits really well into my next question, because obviously I think in order to really empathize with a story and with a love story and with those characters,
it helps if you can identify with them in some way. And I know this is one of the reasons why you wanted to write about the book, because there is such a dearth of romantic stories featuring people of color, particularly when you look at like the kind of classic hit rom-coms of the noughties. Yeah. They're all films fronted by white people. So I know in the introduction to the book, you wrote about how the first time you saw people falling in love that looked like you on screen, it was in an American film. So can you talk to me a bit about what the film was and how that kind of impacted you?
Yeah, the film was Love Jones, which I think came out in, must have been like the late 90s or maybe early 2000s, but it featured the central characters are played by Lorenz Tate and Nia Long, but it's a story that's kind of, you know, he's playing an author and she's a photographer. They are creative people, and sort of the circle in which they moved were people who I just kind of could identify with as creative people, as people who kind of had an interest in the type of music I liked, and you know, they go to poetry nights and things like that. And it just wasn't something I'd seen represented on screen before. You know, I was too young to be like, you know, going off to poetry nights and things like that myself. But it was sort of the first time I saw a black couple on screen falling in love and having a love story like that, where I felt I could really identify with the characters that I was seeing. Because as you say, there are so, well, certainly at that period, at least, there were so few films that I felt did that.
Also, I think it's really important for white people as well. Obviously, this sounds like a really silly point, but it's really important for white people not just to be reared on a culture where they only see love stories fronted by white people.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I talk a bit about that in the introduction to Who's Loving You as well, because it kind of is about that sense of being conditioned to view people a certain way. And this is across all fiction, but I think it's particularly important in romantic stories, that people of color, black people, Asian people, and other minorities are seen as desirable. They're seen as worthy of love. They're seen as people who do fall in love with one another, fall in love with other people. You know, I have encountered people who find it surprising when they read or see stories featuring black people, say, and it's just a love story. They either expect something else to be going on, some kind of trauma or whatever, or they are legitimately surprised that, like, we fall in love and have relationships in the same way that they do, which is disturbing.
It's really disturbing, and it's really absurd. I was talking about this with Baloo Babalola when she came on the show in July, talking about her book, and it's just like, it's this kind of, there's just a real, whenever you do have these love stories that do feature people of color, often the subject matter is at least partly to do with race or racial issues. And obviously to me that's important, but if that is the main focus, it sort of detracts away from the point, because it's like, you need to have these stories where that's not a factor. Otherwise, absolutely, you know, it's just more of that same conditioning. So when you were growing up, how did not kind of seeing yourself represented in popular culture within those kind of romantic stories shape your own understanding of desirability and desirability politics?
I mean, I think inevitably it did lead to a sense that the type of people who were desirable weren't people who looked like me, they were white people. You know, I don't know to what extent I really internalized that, but it was definitely something that it was something I was aware of. And in terms of how it's shaped my sort of relationships going forward, I do think that to a certain extent it has shaped my perceptions of who is desirable, or what other people might think is desirable in me. Or not desirable, as the case may be.
I think that's why, like you said, like, you know, diversity in popular culture is so important, I think, particularly within romantic stories, because it is, you know, falling in love is one of those rare things that most people on the planet probably do. So it's like, if you don't see people who you can identify with, doing that, like you said, inevitably that is going to then fuel some sort of insecurity about, well, am I worthy of love? If I don't look like that, I mean, the only way that I can identify that as a white woman is just in terms of body diversity on screen. Mm-hmm. Because one of the other things that is so rare is to see plus size women fronting these romantic comedies, these classic rom-coms. I'm thinking there was one, there was that Rebel Wilson one not that long ago. Yeah, but like that was like maybe 2 years ago, and that was the first kind of rom-com fronted by a plus size woman. But that's the thing, it wasn't.
Exactly, yeah.
It wasn't. Was that. But that's the way it was sold, because it was like, then there was that whole controversy about it, how it was actually like women of color have been fronting, like plus size women have been fronting these rom-coms. And it's like, it highlighted the whole issue really, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's kind of, as you point out, it's such a universal feeling, the idea of falling in love, or a universal desire at least. I doubt there are many humans on the planet who deep down wouldn't like the sense of finding that one other person who sees them for them and desires them, loves them. And it's not necessarily just obviously a physical thing, but it is so important to sort of have that sense of being recognized for your whole self. That is what love does, is you know, hopefully it will allow you to be seen as in your entirety. And I think if we don't see depictions of that, it's dangerous. It genuinely is. It's dangerous for the people who aren't represented, but it is also dangerous for the people who are represented, because as you say, they need to be conditioned in the same way that others do.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Some of the subjects that the stories touch on, I want to kind of delve into those a bit more. So one of them that I find endlessly fascinating is unrequited love. So I think this topic I find particularly interesting, I think recently, because of now we live in this age of social media and dating apps. That feeling of loving someone and not having them love you back is almost, I feel like, exacerbated in contemporary culture, because, you know, you can never really cut someone out of your life. You can see the person that you adore who doesn't love you back. You can see them on Instagram with their partner who isn't you, or like you can follow their whole relationship. It's like, it's more painful. And I feel like we kind of live in this culture where we indulge that pain and suffering a bit more because there's like something romantic in it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting take on it, because I always think of unrequited love as not necessarily positive, but kind of that sense of yearning is inherently very romantic. And I think that, I guess it depends on whether you've had the sort of opportunity to have a romantic relationship with that person and they've rejected you. I think that's different. And then I think you're right, if you then see them, you know, everywhere you turn on social media with somebody else, that's sort of a different kettle of fish. But I guess there's also the unrequited love where that other person may not even be aware that you're having those feelings towards them. So there's always that sense of potential, which I think, you know, maybe in some regards, it's better not to know a person if you have that kind of sense of unrequited love, because then they're more of a fantasy for you. And that can have its positive aspects as well, I think.
Yeah, it's a really interesting subject. I think traditionally, unrequited love, you know, was the basis of sonnet writing. Like, it was literally an art. There was something artistic about loving someone that doesn't love you back and writing about it. And very often the men, because it was often men writing these sonnets, didn't know the women who they were writing about. But do you think we run the risk, like, because of that history, do you think occasionally we run the risk of romanticizing and kind of fetishizing that feeling of yearning?
Yeah, I think that is a possibility. And I suppose it can be dangerous if people are projecting a sort of ideal on a person they don't really know. And I think that that's true of any relationship, but I do think it is, as you point out, it could be a different dynamic if it's the man projecting an ideal onto women or femininity. That can have its dangerous aspects, because, you know, if men sort of perceive women a certain way and women don't necessarily want to live up to those sort of ideals or stereotypes, you can run into difficulties. So yeah, it's an interesting one.
Mm-hmm. How did you go about when you were choosing the stories? Were you conscious of making sure that they covered like a wide range of different love stories, in terms of, like, you have the unrequited love stories, you have the kind of forbidden love stories, the kind of lost love stories? Were you very conscious of that, so that it was kind of an all-encompassing anthology?
I mean, beyond asking each of the authors to write what they viewed as a love story, I didn't really prescribe things in that sort of way. Mm-hmm. I did determine what they were planning to write and make sure, like, in case there was something that was glaringly similar to another story. But because there is such a multitude of stories, it didn't really come up as an issue. It was really just sort of, maybe in terms of the order of the stories in the book, balancing things out and making sure that two stories weren't, you know, juxtaposed in a way that was sort of too similar. But no, I don't think, I think because of the natural multitude of stories that there are, it didn't come up as an issue.
Mm, it's really funny that, because I think if you tell someone, if you just give someone the brief, tell me a love story, I think it's impossible to get a similar response from two people, because everyone's experience of it is so different. That's why it's such an interesting topic, isn't it? Because it's like, it is, like I said at the beginning, it is something that most people do, but everyone experiences it differently.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So you also talk about this idea of forbidden love. That's in Who's Loving You. And we also kind of, we saw that in your debut novel, right? Mm-hmm. That was kind of based on forbidden love. Talk to me a bit about what that was about and what made you want to write that story.
Yeah, so my debut novel, it's called The Nearness of You, and it came out in 2016. And it is a story about the central character is in love with her best friend's boyfriend, and he has recently moved in with them. So, you know, the torture is extra, extra potent for her. And she's also kind of dealing with a lot of sort of personal issues that have come up for her recently. The story begins with her discovering a suicide by the side of the Thames. It brings up issues of her with her mother and all of this kind of thing. But there is a sort of forbidden love aspect there. Her best friend goes away and she's sort of left in the flat with this man that she's in love with, that she's not meant to be getting involved with, and inevitably there's tension.
It's such an interesting tension to explore that. I think it's like that kind of trio of, like, the best friend getting in the way between the destined lovers is something it's like endlessly gripping. I'm thinking of examples, like I've seen it in, again, these are all examples fronted by white people, which goes back to what we were saying before, but I'm thinking of One Tree Hill, The OC, Something Borrowed, like all of those kind of entities. Yeah. So what was it that made you kind of want to explore that trio dynamic, and how do you think you brought something to it that put, like, a fresh perspective on it? Because, like we said, it is something that we see in so many different kind of forms.
I mean, I think love triangles are sort of, as you say, it's a classic dynamic. But I think in terms of storytelling, tension is so important, or it's important to me, at least, in a story, and romantic tension particularly. So it's just an easy way to create tension by setting up a character dynamic where you know, that these two people aren't supposed to be together. It just heightens the tension between them because you're waiting and waiting and waiting for them to get together. So I think from a narrative perspective, that was why I wanted to explore that. But I think this sort of spin on it, I mean, because if you just take it on the surface, my best friend's boyfriend sounds like something you'd write to an agony aunt or something. But I did want to make it kind of a bit more about, I guess, a bit more realistic. It's sort of kind of a coming of age story. The central character, Taylor, is sort of reconciling a lot of things, not just romantically, but also, as I've said, in her personal life, trying to find a direction. Sort of when I started writing it, it was in that sort of post-university, what am I meant to do? I've done an arts degree, what am I meant to do with that kind of space? So I wanted to make sure that it was relatable in that regard as well. She's a mixed race character, she's a mixed race Black woman, her best friend's a mixed race Black woman as well. So all those aspects, I just kind of wanted to make it feel, a bit different than what you might think of as the cliche when you hear I'm in love with my best friend's boyfriend.
Yeah, it's a dynamic that happens so often in real life as well.
Yes.
Oh, all the time.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it wasn't my experience, just to put it out there, but yeah.
Well, no, I mean, we spoke about this on my previous episode about how women who write about love, because we know that female novelists always get asked how much of their work is biographical, but I think it is particularly targeted at women who write about sex and relationships.
Yes, absolutely.
And I wanted to, this is quite personal, so you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but I am just interested, as someone who's, a lot of my work is about interrogating relationships and kind of asking questions and talking to people about romance, like every 2 weeks that I do on the podcast, mm-hmm. I'm writing a book about it. I noticed the impact that that has on my own relationships. I wonder if you have noticed that in your life, as you have, you know, you have made a career out of this as well.
Yeah.
Has that impacted your own behavior in relationships at all?
Do you know what? Honestly, I don't think it has, in the sense that I kind of feel like, maybe it's because I write fiction, I don't know, but it does feel quite separate. It feels like, I guess when I'm writing, it feels the same way I might feel when I read a romantic story. It's a fantasy to, even though I like quite realistic stories, it's a fantasy to a certain extent. It doesn't feel like how I'd navigate romance in my real life. You know, I've never felt compelled to write a story based on my own life and experience. I mean, I've been with my partner for years, and not to denigrate him, but it doesn't feel like something that I'd be compelled to sort of document in my fiction. It feels very separate for me. And, you know, even previous relationships or dalliances or whatever, I've never thought, let me draw on that experience. It always feels like something I invent completely in my head. But yeah, it is interesting that people, I think it helps once you've had multiple stories out, they realize it can't possibly be that your story is being repeated over and again, but people do have that conception that you're writing your own experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. I think the more stories you kind of churn out, people eventually understand, like, this can't all be about you.
Yeah.
Right, it's time for our Lessons in Love segment. So this is the part of the show where I ask every guest to share something that they've learned from their previous relationship experiences. So Sarita, what is your lesson in love?
I think one of the key lessons I've had is kind of not settling. So I think I've certainly had experiences where I felt just grateful to be in a relationship at all, and I think that is never a good place to be coming from in a relationship. It needs to serve you and it needs to be on your own terms. So I think one of the key lessons is not to settle and not to just be grateful. But to really make sure that relationship is serving you.
I think that's a really good one, because settling is such an easy thing to do, in the sense that you don't necessarily realize you're doing it until you've stopped.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It is sort of a lesson you learn in hindsight, but I think the more you can sort of dial into your own gut feelings about a situation, the more you'll be able to think, no, I deserve better. I deserve something more, something different. Or more just something that supports where I am at this present moment in my life.
How much of that do you think is also about kind of like trusting your own instincts? And like, you know, if you are settling, chances are maybe you have like this kind of like niggling feeling beforehand. Yes. And yeah. You ignore it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is about learning to trust your instincts, trust your gut feelings. I mean, that's easier said than done, because obviously if you're aware you're settling, you're aware something's not quite right. But I think particularly as women, it's kind of easier to think, well, this is something that everyone expects me to do, or everyone strives for, and I've got it, so I shouldn't let it go. I shouldn't take it for granted. That feeling of just being grateful. And it's important we shed that and sort of focus on ourselves.
That's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. If you're a new listener to this show, you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Acast, Spotify, or anywhere else. You can comment and leave us a rating too, so that more people can find us. Keep up to date with everything to do with the show on Instagram. Just search Millennial Love. See you soon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.